Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. This is the weekly show about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. First, we'll speak with Dr. Carrie Sinnott. He's the CEO of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. We'll get an update on trends with asthma and allergies.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm Tim Henney. Our second guests are Todd Hegeman, Technical Director of the Tour of Utah, and Katie Spellflug, owner of Arctique and member of the local organizing committee for Camas, where Stage 5 finishes this year on August 8th.
And that's going to be a great party, so stay tuned for that. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Vinto is a proud sponsor of KPCW. Vinto offers wood-fired pizza and seasonal Italian cooking for lunch and dinner. Nestled at the bottom of Lower Main Street, Vinto is open year-round and now offers a summer menu with new seasonal appetizers, salads, sandwiches, pasta, pizza, and cocktails. More at vinto.com or 615-9990.
The Glitter Tent at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tent restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tent serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Our first guest is Dr. Carrie Sinnott. He's the CEO of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. He'll be joining us to explain what is behind the numbers in a newly released report that may indicate, after decades of increasing asthma rates, that they're actually declining in the U.S. That would be great news, but we'll wait to hear from him on that report. We also want to delve into what it's like from a quality of life perspective to be afflicted with asthma or allergies, how to manage the condition, and if there are any true cures. Dr. Carrie Sinnott, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And you're the head of a very large organization, and we thought that it would be interesting to speak with you to get some national trends about asthma. We seem to see it on the rise here in Utah, and I think a lot of the reason, or what we're attributing the reason to, is poor air quality.
Well, the national the national trend with respect to prevalence, particularly in light of the report that you referenced a moment ago from the CDC, suggests that asthma has been pretty stable. That is, the frequency of asthma has been pretty constant over time. The interesting thing about the CDC report is that it suggests that in this past year, there's been a significant decline, and I think that it would be wonderful if it turns out to be true. But I think we need to be a little bit cautious about interpreting that. But I think the issue that you raise is that the problem of asthma is one that over time has increased as the things that trigger asthma have become more problematic or have not been adequately addressed. And air quality and air pollution is certainly one of those things. Now, my guess is we don't have data on Park City. My guess is that Park City is probably one of the better places to live if you have asthma. We do have some data on Salt Lake City, which suggests that it is, in fact, one of the one of the friendlier asthma capitals, actually allergy and asthma capitals in the country. And that's partly related to air quality, although, again, the air quality in Salt Lake is not, it's not where we would like it to be. But from a pollen perspective and or other allergens that may trigger asthma perspective, Salt Lake City and I suspect Park City are favorable places for people with asthma.
Well, yes, you're probably right on that. You know, we're pretty high in altitude, about 7,000 feet, but with air quality, the poor air quality expanding ever more, we are affected by the air that comes up the valley from Salt Lake, or up the canyons, rather. But what I wanted to ask, when you start using allergens and asthma in the same conversation. Can you talk about the connection of those two, just from a basic medical stance?
Sure. So asthma is a complicated disease that at the end of the day is really caused, or the symptoms of asthma are caused by narrowing of the airways, constriction of the airways. And the airways, the breathing tubes, can become smaller, can become constricted in response to allergens, pollen, dust mites, animal danders. And so there's an allergic reaction that causes the airways to constrict in many asthmatics, and that causes wheezing and shortness of breath and the symptoms of asthma. There is a non-allergic asthma, or the narrowing of the airways can occur not in response to an allergen, but in response to an irritant, and that's where air pollution, secondhand smoke, cold air can irritate the airways and cause them to constrict and therefore cause the same symptoms of wheezing, shortness of breath. And so there's both an allergic and a non-allergic, or what we call an intrinsic and an extrinsic form of asthma. But symptomatically, they present very much the same way. The other point I would make, sort of talking about asthma and allergy in the same breath, if you will, is that they often travel together. Many people with asthma also have other types of allergies, and many people with other types of allergies often have asthma.
Dr. Sennett, I assume that, I think I kind of know this, it's just common sense that this is an individual situation. It's not something that impacts everybody the same way. We all kind of respond to allergens and have an asthmatic response to them in our own individual way. Is there a spectrum that you guys use to kind of mark how challenging it is for different people?
Well, there is a spectrum, or there is a standard classification system, actually, that defines the severity of asthma based on the frequency and the severity of symptoms. So there are some people, who are less affected by it, and then others who are profoundly affected by it. And while I think we've all encountered asthma in our families or among our friends, and it's a condition that can be troublesome, I'm not sure people appreciate that there are thousands of people in the United States who die annually from asthma. So it actually can be a very, very severe condition.
And do we know what the genetic components are that create the condition of asthma?
We know that there are genetic components, but we also know that the genetic determinants of asthma are complicated. It's not a single gene. One of the interesting statistics that I'd like to share is that the prevalence of asthma in identical twins is about 25%. If an identical twin has asthma, it's about 25% likely that his or her identical twin will. So there clearly is a genetic predisposition to it, but it's also not simple, and there are many things that explain asthma that are not genetic.
I'm wondering about that genetic component. In my family, for example, there are four siblings, and two were born with asthma, pretty severe, and one sort of grew out of it. The other one, it mostly crops up during, with allergies. And then I'll use myself. I'm the third one, and I never had any asthma whatsoever until my mid-40s. And so I'm wondering what can trigger it when you've never had it before. I mean, obviously it's genetics, but there must have been some environmental thing that triggered it.
And Lynn, that's almost certainly the case. I mean, we know that the pattern that you described, not within your family, but the different patterns represented in your family are things that we see, and I don't know that we can fully explain. For many people, asthma presents in childhood, and the prevalence of asthma in children is higher than the prevalence in adults. On the other hand, some children outgrow it or it disappears as they age. And then in some cases, the first asthma presentation will be when someone is an adult. It's likely that there is some predisposition to asthma or to the allergic or to the airways response to some irritant or allergen. It may be that one is exposed to that later in life, and it presents later in life simply as a result of environmental exposure. This is one of the things, though, that, again, we worry about as air pollution continues to be more and more a problem, that people who are predisposed to an asthmatic reaction to an irritant will, as the concentration of irritants in the air rises, begin to manifest the symptoms. So it's a real issue, in the adult population as well as in the population of children.
Interesting. So we've talked about allergens and irritants. What about diet?
I'm not aware of any strong link between diet and asthma. Obviously, there are many cases of food allergy where people will have allergic reactions to foods ranging from gastrointestinal symptoms to anaphylaxis, the potentially life-threatening reaction that we associate, for example, with peanut allergy in children.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, it's a very real issue. Food allergy is not something that we want to ignore, but I think that the food allergy, the problem with food allergy, and the presentation of food allergy is largely through an allergic response and not typically through an asthmatic response.
Okay, interesting. Well, we had interviewed a family practice physician one day about an entirely different topic, and she just happened to mention that she had begun to get have exercise-induced asthma, and she had visited a naturopathic physician in town who took her off gluten and red meat, and she said her asthma went away. And so it's very interesting that we use our own anecdotal evidence, and I've been toying around with that. We know that gluten is now getting being implicated in many different types of health issues, and it's hard to distinguish between what's sort of trendy and what's real. But what do you think about the possibility of something like gluten? I mean, becoming an allergen when it maybe wasn't before.
I think there are all sorts of possibilities, and there are many anecdotes. My best understanding of the scientific literature here is that there's never been sort of a strong association between food and asthma, number one, and number two, that many of the naturopathic remedies have not been demonstrated, at least in rigorous scientific studies, to be effective, reducing the symptoms of asthma in people who have asthma. That doesn't mean that there isn't a lot that we don't know, but I do think that in a world in which there is a strong commitment to science and to evidence-based decision making, at this point, there isn't a lot of evidence that would suggest that some of these naturopathic or homeopathic approaches are the best way to go. As always, I think it's very important, number one, that we keep an open mind and that we be prepared to learn. Number two, I think it's very important that people with asthma and allergy talk with their doctors to make sure that their doctor is apprised and the doctor can provide guidance as they consider different ways of treating their disease.
Dr. Sennett, this gets me thinking about what has surprised you as you've been looking at the evidence and the scientific inquiry has been happening over the last 50 years or so. What are the things when you keep an open mind and you allow for the possibility of a surprise? What has surprised you over the last couple of decades?
Well, I'll tell you, this may not be the kind of answer that you're looking for, but what surprised me is that we really know so much about how to manage the symptoms in people with asthma, but that we're not having the effect that we, I believe, could have as consistently as the science suggests we should. So we know that the environment and triggers in the environment are very important to driving symptoms in people who have asthma. And we know how to cleanse the environment, but we still see a lot of people living in settings in which they're exposed to allergens and their asthma flares, and we haven't figured out how to solve that problem. We know that there are medications that can be very helpful in terms of reducing, not just sort of on a rescue basis, reducing symptoms, but actually preventing symptoms, controlling longer term. But we find that people don't use those controllers as consistently and as effectively as they could. Those are problems that aren't exactly healthcare problems, but they're problems that we need to address if we're going to improve the lives of people with asthma and allergy. And I'm surprised, to be honest, that we continue to need to make progress on fronts where we know what to do, but we don't seem to be doing it as consistently and as effectively as I believe we can.
So that gets me to wondering about this high predisposition, from a genetic standpoint, to allergens and an asthmatic reaction combined with poor air quality. And the one we can't control, right? We're born with it. It's in our genes. But
right,
the other
right.
one, the environmental impacts, the poor air quality, we can control. And then there's this third element that we can control also, which is how we treat and manage the symptoms. How do the two areas that we can control play in? And to me, it just seems like, I don't know, people don't really take into the people that I've talked to about this kind of thing, air quality when they talk about asthma. I mean, I know people who live in Salt Lake City and they're like, the kids all have asthma, and yet they're living down in Salt Lake City, which in my opinion has extremely poor air quality. So they're combining two things together that results in, you know, a challenge for their children.
Well, I think you've laid it out, Tim, very thoughtfully. And I think the question is sort of, well, what can we do? And partly that's what can we do as individuals, and then what can we do as communities? I think as individuals, people with asthma really should understand their disease, and they should understand the things that trigger their disease, and they should work on reducing the exposure to those triggers to the extent that they're able. Allergens in the home or allergens in the workplace may be things that they can address. On the other hand, air pollution is something that we as a community have to address, and that requires voters, it requires political action, it requires people not just caring for themselves, but people being part of a community that's invested in caring for others in that community as well as themselves. And so I think on the one hand, people with asthma, there's a lot that they can do. It begins with education, begins with conversations with their physician. I'd like to suggest that AFA, the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America website, AAFA.org, provides a lot of information that can help people with asthma and allergy understand what they can do to improve their lives. But we also need, as population, to address these bigger drivers like air quality. And we do that by writing our congressmen, and we do that by voting, and we do that, through other types of political action.
Dr. Sen, I'd love to circle back to the surprise question one more time, and I know you've already kind of answered this, but I'm just wondering, on sort of a scale of surprise, how surprising would it be to you and your community if there were a proven link between diet and allergens?
Well, I guess it would be surprising to me. On a scale of 1 to 10, I don't know, probably an 8 or a 9. And I say that because asthma is primarily a condition that has to do with airway reactivity and an allergic reaction in the airways, in the breathing tubes, which are pretty physiologically and anatomically distinct from the GI tract, which is, where one would be exposed, to potential food allergen. I'm prepared to be surprised, but I don't. But it would be, I think, pretty significant surprise.
Well, I have a anecdotal story that I have to share because I do it all the time. And I know Lynn wants to hear this again. But over a year ago, I started drinking every morning what I call a glowing green smoothie, which is vegetable, spinach, and fruit-based. And it doesn't have any additives. And I blend it in a blender. And I drink it every single morning. And when I started that, my allergies, which had begun progressively worse, and they were seasonal, they were all kicked off in the spring and continued through the summer, and sometimes I had a relapse in the fall, went away. I've had, so far, last summer, complete summer, without any allergic episodes whatsoever, or even, you know, minor symptoms. And this year so far, the same situation. So I don't know, you know, anything about this, except that I do know that the, you know, diet has something to do with inflammation. Certain foods are more inflammatory and certain foods are less inflammatory. It seems like if your, you know, air tracts are closing down, there's inflammation. So maybe there's some sort of connection there. But just my experience has been really amazing with diet and its result with my allergies.
Tim, it's a good point, and I want to emphasize and I want to call it out. I mean, people who have food, I don't know if you have an underlying food allergy, but people who have food allergies and asthma, there may actually be a relationship, and it almost certainly has to do with the point that you just made, which is that people who are hypersensitive, people who have an underlying predisposition to react allergically, may have associated reactions both to food and to allergens that prompt these symptoms of asthma. So, and I don't know if you have any food allergy as well, but it is true that asthma and allergy travel together, including asthma and food allergy. And then in people with food allergy, there may actually be a relationship between the food allergy and the asthma.
Yeah, and what's weird is I am unaware of any food allergies whatsoever. Mine are simply pollen, and seasonal pollen allergies.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Well, maybe it's as simple as, you know, it's the one step further when you introduce a food allergy. And, you know, whereas air quality can create the asthma, it's the reaction to an allergen that then creates the asthma when it comes to food.
Right.
That being the connection, it just takes one more step. Yeah, very interesting. You know, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that there are, I forgot what you said, or if you said that statistics on how many people a year die from asthma in the U.S. Did you give us a number?
Yeah, I did. I said there were thousands. We estimate that there are about 3,000 people who die annually from asthma.
It's so hard to believe, yet I know it happens, and it must be just a horrible death, really. What is it really that creates, is it complete blockage? Is it the feeling that when you're having an asthma attack, you panic even more, and then it kind of increases exponentially the symptom?
No, it is, ultimately, it is the fact that people can't breathe in and out, and actually the problem in asthma is really with the exhaling, because the airways narrow, and as you exhale, they close. You can't move air out, then you can't bring fresh air in, and that usually has to do with, you know, very severe constriction, and in response to an irritant or to an allergen. But some people have that very, very severe reaction. And those are the ones that they can be very difficult to treat. And in some cases, a treatment may simply not be, may not be able to save their lives.
Mm. Our guest is Dr. Carey Sinnott. He's the CEO of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. And Dr. Sinnott, wanted to ask you, you know, we talk about air quality, but has the Asthma and Allergy Foundation broken it down to which chemical components in the air we breathe that are the biggest triggers for asthma? I mean, we talk about ozone, and then there's particulate matter, and there are all these chemical elements that go into the air that are released.
Yeah. I don't think I can say which elements. I think it's the collection of the irritants and ozone and particulate matter, hydrocarbon emissions, some of the things in secondhand cigarette smoke. Each of them contributes. How much each contributes individually, don't know, but it is the combination of irritants that ultimately is the problem that we have to solve.
Interesting. Well, we've talked mostly about asthma here, and we're just about out of time, but I have to ask you this question about allergies. Why are we seeing more and more allergies to things like peanuts, especially in our children?
I'm not sure. The answer may be that we're more aware of the problem and more of this is coming to light. So I think it is, to some extent, the visibility of the issue has risen. I'm not aware of data that suggests that the underlying sort of tendency to react to peanuts has changed. But it clearly is a problem. It's a real problem. And is a life-threatening issue that, significantly affects the lives not only of the children, but of the families who are raising those children.
Yes.
It's a very, very serious issue.
Absolutely. I know we had at least one child who had an extreme peanut allergy growing up through the same year in school as one of my children. And it really affects the entire community, really, because everyone has to rally around eliminating peanuts. Well, very interesting. Just wanted to ask you finally, what are some of the most important things that you're working on in the Asthma and Allergy Foundation right now?
I think what we're trying to do, we're actually probably trying to address the things that Tim raised. We're working on the advocacy front to try to increase awareness, but also to solve the problem of air pollution and irritants in the air that cause asthma or that cause symptoms in people with asthma. At the same time, we're working very hard to educate patients about how they can manage their own illness and provide support to physicians, to asthma educators, to those who provide care to people with asthma about what they need to do in order to make sure that people with asthma or asthma and allergy have the best outcomes that they can. So our focus is really on advocacy, particularly with respect to air quality, patient education and helping the patient be an effective partner with his or her physician, managing the environment, helping people understand not just on the air quality front, but on the allergen front, what they can do as individuals and what communities need to do as communities in order to reduce allergen exposure. And then again, I'm trying to provide as much of this information to individuals through what we provide on our website and through other channels.
Very good. The website again is aafa.org, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America.
Very good. Well, Dr. Carrie Sennett, thank you so much for your time today. It's an interesting conversation.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We were just speaking with Dr. Carrie Sennett, who is the president and CEO of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. For more information and some interesting articles, including those cities that are deemed the worst for asthma and allergies in the country, you can go online, again, aafa.org. Stay with us. We'll be back to talk about the tour of Utah coming up next month.
This is Bobby Trunzo, PGA head golf professional at Park Meadows Country Club and supporter of KPCW. Our Jack Nicklaus signature design golf course, golf instruction, clinics, practice facilities, and indoor golf simulator offer something for every golf enthusiast. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Hi, this is Kevin Stocking, president of Heber Valley Bank. We offer a full spectrum of loans for lots, construction, HELOCs, commercial, and personal needs. Our loan decisions are made locally. Heber Valley Bank is a proud supporter of KPCW. We are located in Heber City and Midway and at Grand Valley Bank in Park City. HeberValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, it's that time of summer again to talk tour. No, not Tour de France. Well, maybe Tour de France. We'll talk about in a minute. But the Tour of Utah, that's right. The Tour of Utah has hit the big time. And here to tell us about this year's tour is Todd Hegman. He's the technical director for the tour, working behind the scenes for his fourth year after riding in the tour the first six. Todd now oversees a staff of 700 and gets to experience firsthand many of the hidden gems of Utah, the off-the-beaten-track towns the tour now incorporates each year. They're towns like Panguitch and Torrey. And wait, it's Camas. That's right. Camas will host the finish of the Stage 5 on August 8th. And for those in the know, this is really an amazing occurrence. So who better to talk about how this came to be than a member of the local organizing committee from Camas, here to tell us what's on tap for the big day and all that goes into preparing the town to welcome the tour is Katie Stelflug, owner of Artique Gallery in Camas. And welcome, Todd and Katie. It's nice to have you both here.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks.
Let's see. So where do we start? Why don't we start with the route of the whole tour? Now, last year was the first year you incorporated Southern Utah, which is a huge hit because there are really, I don't know, how many millions of viewers around the world that tune into this?
Oh, we hit 123 countries viewed into this. And again, this year we were on Fox Sports Network nationwide so that we were hitting up to 90 million homes a day on a daily basis for 2 hours. So from 2 to 4 p.m. each day, we are having live coverage in HD on Fox Sports Network and Eurosport 2. And so again, Eurosport 2 is going to be picking this up for all of our European viewers.
And what was the response when the viewers see Southern Utah? Is there any way to measure that?
You know, I'm sure there are from the TV production side. I haven't actually seen those numbers, but just from the feedback and in the social media that we've heard, that it was just an overwhelming positive response to Southern Utah, and it made it easier for us to go back.
Yeah, right. I guess the fact that the broadcasters are there and they want to do it again is pretty good indication that they like what they saw and they got a good response.
Right. And so we manage the production. Fox Sports and Eurosport are simply our vehicles on which to view it. So they're not involved in the production of it. It's still our production team. But from what we've got back from from Eurosport, from our sponsors, it's been overwhelming. And the towns. And if you've spent time down in Southern Utah, there's a large European presence down in Southern Utah. And so there was a lot of enthusiasm down there.
Yeah, that's great. And it's not to discount at all Northern Utah, which of course is beautiful. But
right.
But there's nothing like Southern Utah anywhere in the world. Especially not in Colorado or California, where those other tours are, right?
No, the down in Grand Staircase Escalante area, I've personally fallen in love with it down there. I've spent probably almost half my summer, it seems like, traveling down there. I've been down there 4 times in the last 3 weeks.
Wow.
In preparation of it. And it gives me goosebumps thinking about Stage 1 and 2, and in particular Stage 2. Again, not discounting Northern Utah, but man, if you haven't spent time on Highway 12 in the towns of Boulder and Escalante and Tropic, you haven't been to Utah.
I don't want to get too far into the weeds, Todd, but this whole thing about you guys produce the video, I mean, you're producing what goes out as a feed to these channels that then show it to the world, but you guys run a pretty big operation here. Can you tell us a little bit about what's involved in the production of the Tour of Utah? And it's not just the bike riding, it's the creation of the video, it's the venues, it's bringing people like Katie on board with the local organizing committees. How does all that play out?
It is a big production. It's mostly a year-round production. I technically work for a company called Medal of Sports, and so we're the event production company that put on Tour California, Tour of Utah, U.S. Pro Challenge in Colorado, and many other races. Go back to the days of the Tour de Pont was the genesis of the medalist sports. And so we work year-round with the Larry H. Miller Group and their production crew who do the sponsorship sales, the marketing, the PR, all of those pieces. We have weekly meetings year-round on this. And so there's probably a year-round staff in one capacity or another of about 30 people at a very minimum. And then, as Lynn had mentioned, race week with the staff and the teams and the support, we're looking at, we move about 700 people a day from stage to stage.
And is it kind of dialed in at this point as far as, you know, you've got 30 people working year-round and they're kind of managing what you're going to be doing? Because I know for years this was building, being created. Have you created the production and now you're managing it, or is there still creation and challenges that come along?
There are, but
it must be different.
In each year it's a little bit different. Last year our big challenge were the first race to go through the national parks. That was a big deal, so I spent a lot of time tap dancing with the National Park Service and the National Forest Service, and we still have to do that a bit, but it's usually those rookie towns like as Katie could attest to that need a little bit more hand-holding. So if we come back to Camas next year, I probably won't be talking to Katie nearly as much.
It's gonna be easy.
Yeah. And so it's one of those things where you need to do it once, and then there's certainly a learning curve for these communities. And as Utah's not a huge state, there's not that many towns that we can go to. So we're getting more and more alumni city, so it makes it a little bit easier. Really jinxing myself for next year.
Yeah, right.
a little bit easier.
So you've got a town like Panguitch, and that's where the tour day one ends. It goes from Cedar City to Panguitch. Is that right?
No. Stage one, we're starting and finishing in Cedar City.
Oh, okay.
And stage two, we start in Panguitch outside of Bryce Canyon there, and then we finish in Torrey.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it must be a little difficult at the onset to get these host cities to sign up in a way, especially if they're not, you know, if their population is not really big cycling enthusiasts. You compare it to little towns that the Tour de France goes through, and they probably love to have it because it's a cycling culture,
right?
And we are less so, but becoming more so.
Well, and that was a concern when the start of this, Steve Miller and I hopped into a Subaru and went down and knocked on doors of Panguitch and Cedar City and Torrey, and I'll never forget the meetings I had with the mayor of Torrey in this little office. I mean, Torrey's a town of 170 people, and saying, hey, we want to bring this race to Torrey. And there's definitely a big deer in the headlights look, and for the whole summer. And also in those small towns, there's a lot of enthusiasm, but at the same time, they don't know cycling, and there's a lot of rumor mill. And I remember this one instance where we got an email from the mayor of Torrey late at night where the rumor in town had spread like wildfire that 100,000 people were going to be in Torrey. Yeah,
we don't have enough bathrooms.
Right, right. And so you're managing those type of, you're trying to manage those expectations and put out those fires and try to give as much information as possible. And again, once they see it for the first time, then they understand and they see that it's relatively painless, if you will, as the race comes through these towns. And we're pretty much a plug and play type of operation where we take care of a lot of the heavy lifting. But yeah, but I think we're finding that the true heart and soul of the Tour of Utah, and this is in my opinion, is in these small communities.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the towns of Camas, it's in Panguitch, it's in Torrey.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it, there's a lot of enthusiasm down there. And I think we love going to Salt Lake City, don't get me wrong, or Ogden, but those towns have a lot of other events that they're dealing with.
Right.
Where when we come to Camas, guess what? We're pretty big deal this summer in Camas, as Katie can attest to, and it's exciting to see these small communities embrace a Tour of Utah. In fact, in Garfield County last year's, I love this comment, because the town of Escalante, much like Camas, is having their city council approve their first ever public beer garden for the Tour of Utah. And the head of tourism there said the Tour of Utah is breaking down barriers in Garfield County. And we're like, Love it. Yeah.
Like the Zion curtain.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if it's a beer garden.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. And it must be. So we'll bring Camus and Katie into the conversation here. But it must be with little towns like Torrey. The first year, they're kind of deer in the headlights. The second year, they go, oh, we've got this wired. We're going to do this and this differently. And we're going to add the beer garden. We're going to add a band. And we're going to do this sort of thing. It sounds like Camus. And Katie, you can talk about this. Camus has embraced this in a big way the first year, and you're planning all kinds of things. So talk about what you're planning.
Back in, December was the first talks we had with the city about bringing this race, and Todd got me on board, and I was, of course, a supporter and got some friends at the city council meeting to support the coming of the race. And then, of course, over time, then it was official, and I got friends of mine on board, and now we have a local organizing committee of about 20 people that have been working hard for the past 3 or 4 months on this race and expo and festivities that are going along with the race. A couple of things we have on board, of course, is a beer garden, and we're going to have also live music. Pete Rude will be playing with some friends there, and right around in our expo, and the U of U Healthcare brings in a kids' bike race, so there will be a kids' bike race to the finish at 1 o'clock on that day. And then we will also have a BMX show that will be fun for, families and people to come out to see other things besides just the Tour of Utah race.
Katie, from your experience, is kind of comparing to the other towns that Todd was talking about and that deer in the headlight initial reaction. I'm sure you had that in Camus because there is a cultural difference, Camus about biking and sort of the activities. And I know that I've heard that there's been, some trepidation, but you've worked through that, or do you think that that was easier to work through in Camus because of the proximity to Park City and the bicycles that are out on the road all the time anyway? I mean, what sort of challenges did you have, or what do you think was available to you that might not have been available to some of those southern Utah towns?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still working through it, just trying to get the word out to everyone in town. We have a much bigger population base than Torrey or Panguitch or any of those towns. They have the proximity to the national parks and get the tourists. We also do have, the proximity to big tourist area, so a lot of people coming through. I think we'll get the crowds from Park City and Salt Lake, being close to those.
Yeah, I think you will too.
But working on the locals is the hardest thing, and the road closures and that. But we're just really trying to reach out to them to say this is a family event, and this is not necessarily just about pro cycling. It's about a big festival that's happening, and just to put Camus on the map and show what a beautiful town we do have. And
that festive atmosphere that you just mentioned, I know you're working on a special project out of Artique with the flags and the poles that have been donated from Soul Poles. Can you tell us what you're doing there?
Yeah, so
and anything else that might be along those lines of kind of adding to the festive environment?
Mm-hmm. I thought, when we first got this race, I wanted to, put some color into town, and I talked to Kathleen Briley out in Oakley, and she does kids art camps in the summer, and she also is a teacher now at the elementary school in Camus. And I really wanted to get the kids and families involved with decorating the town, and she made these beautiful prayer flags just over a year ago with the kids at the elementary school. And I pictured them being a little bit larger, but individual flags. And so last weekend at Artique, we did we got kids there to paint flags. And we've already got a few made, and we're looking to get hundreds of more to line the streets as you come into Camus to really make it festive and colorful.
And so, also Camus is getting some what will become permanent beautification things. Like, I think you've raised money for flower pots or something like that on the...
Yeah, Jeff Camp with High Country Properties headed up a little project there and got some flower pots on the streets to get some color as well there, and we're trying to raise enough money with our local organizing committee to get the money back to him to pay for that, and then hopefully that will be a continuation into the future of getting Camus a little bit more beautified and you know, inviting for mm-hmm. people to come through.
So it'll be a big party. The race starts in Evanston, stage five starts in Evanston, comes up over the Mirror Lake Highway, right?
Correct.
And then screaming down into Camas for the finish. About what time will that take place?
Well, there's a little bit more to that. Actually, when we come into Camas, the riders aren't going to finish there the first time. They're going to head down 32 into Oakley, up around Weber Canyon and New Lane, down over to Wooden Shoe and Pioa.
Oh.
And then the exciting part is they're going to be racing on the dirt part of Democrat Alley.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And yeah. So then they'll be going across to Lambert Lane, and then it's going to be a big sprint finish down, again, State Route 32 back into the finish in front of City Hall. So it's going to add to the party that they'll be able to see the riders twice. So it's going to be an exciting day in Camas. And I really have to take my hat off to Katie and her crew, because you can just see the excitement that's happening in Camas. Like I said, I think the heart and soul are in these small towns, and they've done a great job. And we've been working on this for several months now, and I think it should be said that I think the cycling environment over in Eastern Summit County has drastically changed. In the attitudes and the welcoming of cyclists, and I think there's been actually kind of a meeting in the middle between the local residents, cyclists, and I think there's a mutual respect that might not have been there a few years ago. I think mm-hmm. that Katie and her crew's done a great job to mend some bridges over in Eastern Summit County.
Todd, have you seen legacy benefits in these other towns like the Tories and Panguitches? And I know it's relatively new that you've been going to the small towns, mm-hmm. but, you know, Camas, and Katie just mentioned, there's a beautification project. There are flags that are going to create a festive atmosphere. Have Panguitch and Tory and places like that benefited in ways that maybe they didn't anticipate? And, you know, they've got flower boxes and a different atmosphere about the place, or the culture is shifting a little.
Sure. I think the biggest difference that we have seen is, especially down south, I think you've got towns like Panguitch that have traditionally been, and Escalante Tropic, for years they were extraction-based industries. Now they've got, they're more tourism-based, and I think this has really helped them turn the corner a little bit to see that they've got this beautiful Grand Staircase Escalante, that in Camas is a little bit like this as well. They've been rural, and they're grappling with how to attract a different business that they haven't
just
necessarily...
Just to diversify a bit.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where I've personally seen the difference in down south, these towns, okay, being able to embrace with Escalante. We're just a pass-through community, but Escalante is going to be having Beer Garden and Brats, and they are putting a big banner above the street. Panguitch and Tory, if you drive through those towns right now, they've got asphalt stickers for the last month on where the start and finishes are going to be for the Tour of Utah. So and they're using those lessons in some other the events that they're having there as well to attract different businesses and different events. And when I go down to State Route 12 or Cedar City, you see that. You see that other events and other cycling groups are now being attracted. They didn't know of those areas before, mm-hmm. and now it's opened the door. Mm-hmm. It amazes me the amount of people that haven't been to that part of the state. People have been to Moab, they've been to Zions, but quite honestly, like I said, that part of the state is just, it's mind-blowing.
And Katie, how about taking that thought to Camas and projecting out into the future? I'm sure the local organizing committee, when you guys get together, you sort of talk about what benefits might accrue in the future to Camas if this goes successfully, if the community embraces it, if there's the enjoyment that we all hope to see over there, if the beer garden comes out without incident, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. can you project out and say this is, again, shifting the culture of the community or adding things that might be a little surprising?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, as a business owner on Main Street in Camas, I think, my hope is that Camas sees this as a step towards the future and embracing the tourism that they already have coming through. But I think so many people pass through and don't stop in Camas. There's a lot of great restaurants and shops and things to do in Camas, and but then there's also a few empty buildings and storefronts that I think would be great to see filled, and to see that shift come back to Main Street instead of, going out of town, getting the Main Street looking more inviting and getting, you know, the tourism aspect of things going more, and just embracing that, the visitors.
Great. Well, good luck with the project. And we hope to talk to the mayor of Camas next week or the week following, Mayor Marchant, about his take on the whole thing. And it sounds like he's coming along, and it'll be fun. Of course, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Park City and how the tour comes through here. It'll be the final stage, right, on Sunday?
Right. We actually, just like last year, we'll be coming on 2 days.
Okay.
So the Queen stage starts from Salt Lake City and is finishing at Snowbird. This is also going to be the ultimate challenge as well. So there's going to be up to 900 recreational cyclists coming through on that Saturday, heading up from Browns Canyon, up the Mine Road to Guardsman's, which has been such a, if you've been up there, it's been a busy place to ride this summer.
Yeah.
Down Big Cottonwood and then over to Little. And then on Sunday is the big day. We start and finish on Main Street, just like last year, heading out of town, but going to Camas again, over to Wolf Creek Ranches, and then up Empire Pass, and then down, screaming down the Mine Road. And same thing, the expo is going to be on Main Street. Party's going to be starting early on Main Street.
Right. Okay. And why is Snow Basin not included this year? So you start from Salt Lake instead of Snow Basin on that stage.
Yeah, it was wanted to change it up a little bit. Snow Basin start without a population there was a little quiet.
Yeah,
for a start line. No offense to Snow Basin. And then Salt Lake City, from a logistical standpoint, with our teams and our staff, as well as the ultimate challenge, it made it logistically a lot easier to start in Salt Lake City and finish in Snowbird. It's a much shorter commute, if you will. Of course, it added two climbs, so that's even a harder stage this year because they're going up Immigration Canyon over Big Mountain, which are two new climbs that they didn't have last year.
Okay, great. So you can, of course, as recreational cyclists can sign up for the ultimate challenge.
Yes.
Still, I suppose there's plenty of, does the registration close due to numbers or just time?
There's going to be a little bit of both. There's still a couple hundred spots left for the ultimate challenge, and you have a couple more weeks, I believe, for the registration.
Okay, Tim's going to sign up.
All right, Tim.
I keep threatening.
Yeah.
But you may have just taken it off the table for me, the extra climb.
Well, they do. I should say they do have also additional start points. And so if you want to
good.
Start in Salt Lake
is
or
there
Colville.
Is there one at the top of the guard road?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea.
I did it last year. It was one of the hardest rides I've ever done, even though it seems a little, well, it's not short. It was 116 miles, but it's way harder than Lodija or anything like that, I think.
Oh, yeah. And it's a little bit shorter this year, but yeah, it's up to 13,000 feet of climbing. It's a tough day.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Todd Hageman and Katie Stelflug, thanks so much for coming in today. Good luck, and let us know if there's anything we can do to help you out as the tour of Utah descends on Summit County. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Summer is here at Utah Olympic Park. Olympic-sized adventure awaits you on the zip lines, alpine slide, adventure ropes courses, and the always popular Summer Comet bobsled ride. Don't miss the Flying Ace All-Stars freestyle show every Sunday at 1 p.m. The park is open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. with activities available beginning at 10 a.m. For activity tickets, season passes, and more information, go to utaholympiclegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Want to thank our underwriters.
Park City Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, and of course, Vinto Pizzeria.
Yum. And tune in tomorrow for Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. We'll be talking about the underwater world and also some lines for new electric cars. It's some wild project they're doing at Utah State University. This is The Mountain Life, and you're listening to KPCW Park City. Time for news.
In Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Obama will travel to Texas today, where he's expected to address the immigration crisis. House Speaker John Boehner says the president needs to take quick and forceful action to ease the growing crisis.
I sent a letter to the president more than 2 weeks ago outlining actions that he could take already under the law. And yet he's not followed any of those recommendations.
The president's trip comes months after debate over the increasing number of minors crossing the border illegally. Obama has asked Congress for $3.7 billion to deal with the surge. At least 28 people are dead in the Gaza Strip following Israeli airstrikes. Government spokesman Mark Regev says the Israeli military is stepping up efforts to end the threat of Hamas rocket fire.
We tried to de-escalate. Messages were sent. We told Hamas to stop this rocket fire, but they continued. And now we are acting. The Israeli Defense Forces are acting to bring about a situation where the people of Israel no longer have to live in fear.
Israeli officials are warning the offensive will be long-term. Palestinian legislator Mustafa Barghouti says Palestinians are suffering greatly as Israel raises the stakes.
Israel provokes the situation, attacks Palestinians, and the world media does not speak about that. And then eventually when Palestinians respond, everything becomes in the light of the media. The reality here is that Israel is responsible for this escalation.
The recent fighting is the heaviest between Israel and Hamas since an eight-day battle in November of 2012. The Pentagon says no decision has yet been made about whether its troubled new all-purpose jet fighter, the F-35 Lightning II, will make its international debut at two British air shows that get underway later this week. As NPR's David Wellner reports, the Pentagon's entire fleet has been grounded after one jet caught fire last month.
Pentagon spokesman John Kirby says nobody wants to rush the F-35 Joint Strike